negotiate at the table, but it put Israel in a weakened political and social and sovereignty position compared even to what she'd had before the war of 1967. For not only was Israel told that she would have to withdraw from the Sinai, from Gaza, and from the West Bank. Of course, there was some comment about minor border rectification. But she was told that Jerusalem would become an international city, ruled jointly by a Jordanian and Israeli force, task force. And in return, there would have to be some kind of profession by Egypt and by Jordan of the sovereignty of Israel. But there was no mention of how they would Egypt and Jordan would police the guerrillas. There was no mention of how Egypt and Jordan would live up to, over a period of years, this acceptance of Israel's sovereignty. There was a statement that the Israelis would be given the right to have their flagships and ships bound for Israeli ports move through the Suez Canal and through the Gulf of Tehran. And there was to be an area-wide meeting to deal with the problem of the Arab refugees. As the year ended, Israel was concerned that the United States was eager only to be disembarrassed of this Middle Eastern confrontation, and that she was willing to use economic and military pressures, that is, the closing off of the pipeline for military hardware, the closing off of certain kinds of monies which have flown from the United States to Israel, in order to bring Israel to the bargaining table and to enforce this bargain upon Israel. And the Israelis remembered 1957, when again under American pressure, having been given some kind of vague promise by the State Department that the Suez and Tehran would stay open, that there would be a demilitarized zone along her borders, that there would be an effective United Nations peacekeeping force, Israel had withdrawn from Gaza and the Suez, only to see the whole cycle of rearmament, of attack, of the war of attrition waged again, launched again against her. The United States, as 1970 progressed, continued along this simplistic line, hurrying towards this simple goal. Jarring mission, negotiation tables, arrangements, let's disembarrass ourselves of the whole issue. And the climax of this American simplicity was the ceasefire fiasco of August 7th. A 90-day ceasefire imposed largely by American sense of urgency, imposed upon the Middle East, particularly upon Israel, by Americans who were eager to find quick answers to complex problems. Israel was assured that there was to be a standstill ceasefire. Israel was assured that the United States stood behind this ceasefire. Why was this ceasefire of concern to Israel? Because her response to the war of attrition had been an aerial war, 100 days of serious bombardment of Egyptian fortifications, an effective counterpose. She had to keep the Russian ground-to-air missiles moving up to the canal zone, because if they moved up to the canal, they would preclude high-level Israeli attack deep into Egyptian territory, and they would gain control of airspace not only above their own defensive positions, but against the Israeli defensive positions on the other side of the canal. And once Israel loses the ability to move in the air freely, then the commando raids can begin again in earnest. Then the bombardment can begin again in all seriousness. America assured Israel that she had nothing to worry about, and in fact, Israel had a great deal to worry about. Within minutes of that midnight deadline on the 7th of August, Russian and Egyptian forces were moving SAM-2 and SAM-3 ground-to-air missiles further and further up towards the canal. In the event, it turned out that America believed she had commitments, which in fact she did not have, or that the Egyptians and the Russians had deliberately lied to our officials overseas. Whatever be the case, America proved impotent in effecting the ceasefire. We proved that we were not only impotent, but we were innocents abroad. We had not even ordered aerial reconnaissance over the area in order to see that the ceasefire was being enforced. And so the ceasefire was a diplomatic fiasco, which we first tried to deny, and then we shamefacedly admitted, and then we tried to buy our way out of the results of this political and international defeat by allowing certain millions of dollars worth of military hardware to go to Israel. The year was mushy. America was discovering that there were no simple answers to the complex problems of international politics. And during the last half of the year, we were to learn how infinitely complex the issues of the Middle East really were. It was not simply a matter of arranging negotiations between Jordan and Israel and Egypt and Israel. There were the guerrillas. And who were the guerrillas, and how powerful were they, and what were their purposes? During much of that middle and last half of 1970, the guerrillas fought with their own, not against Israel. There was the battle between the Sa'ika and the Lebanese forces. There was a battle between the Al-Fatah and the other against King Hussein and the forces of the royal government of Jordan. The United States learned that she dealt not only with Israel and the Arab states, but with Israel and a guerrilla force, and that the guerrilla force was not willing to accept binding commitments made by the Arab states, even if they had been willing to make them. And that this guerrilla force was, in fact, a revolutionary force within the Arab world, which had sometimes Russian, sometimes Chinese, sometimes purely idiosyncratic ambitions for the overthrow of existing governments. The Middle East became unstuck. There was war between Arab and Arab. And the United States learned, as the year drew to its close, the value of having at least a staunch small ally in that part of the world. Because when the guerrillas and the Jordanians began to fight with each other, a fight which resulted in a terrible defeat for the guerrillas, they had been driven up to their mountain fastness, much of the aura of romance which surrounded them for a year or so has been taken from them, certainly it has been tarnished. But as that war progressed, the revolutionary government of Syria, which was in fact certainly a revolutionary guerrilla government, began to send a tank force into Jordan in order to meet the Royal Jordanian Army on its own terms. The United States could not make an effective military response. We had ships in the area, but not tanks. Public opinion in the United States was not prepared for American military involvement in that part of the world. So under the urging of the United States, the Israelis massed their troops, their tanks, on the heights of Golan within sight of this Syrian tank column. And the Syrians got the message. And the tank column withdrew. An immoderate Arab government, which we have sponsored these last years and which the British government sponsored before us, the Jordanian government, was saved, paradoxically, by the government of the Jewish state. As the year progressed, the American State Department seemed to gain a glimmering of the fact that she would have to walk cautiously in the Middle East, that she could not expect miracles, simple solutions, quick, hurried-up solutions to these problems. But hope seems to breed eternal in the innocent breasts of some of these people. And as the year ends, there is again the pressure in Washington to try and bring Israel to the bargaining table, to force Israel to make the compromises which would benefit Washington, which has vital interests which are somehow different than Israel's vital interests in that part of the world. Will there be peace in the Middle East? Not in a hurry, not in any jig time, not in brief, but what all of us sense is that though the second ceasefire now in existence is fragile and has only a short time to run, there is now new possibility. Complexity itself gives you room for diplomacy. Nasser has died. Sadat is making the same noises that Nasser once made. But Sadat is an ex-Nazi without the charisma for the West, which somehow Nasser, with all his megalomania, had. There is new strength in Jordan. There is a new recognition of the limited capability of the so-called Palestinian guerrillas. There's a new recognition of the usefulness of the military power of Israel for the West, particularly for the United States in that part of the world. There is elbow room for diplomacy. There is mushiness, and yet somehow one senses some glimmer of possibility. And what was true during 1970 of the Middle East was equally true of Southeast Asia. Nothing was clear, yet somehow as the year ends, one senses that for all of this mushiness, for all this slush, we were moving towards our ultimate objective, disengagement. 1970 was in Southeast Asia a paradoxical year. On the one hand, it was obvious that Hanoi and Washington remained at opposite poles in their professed verbal statements of the possibilities for solution. President Nixon was still talking of winning the peace. President Nixon was still talking of a vast all-Southeast Asian conference in which all the issues would be adjudicated, and until then, a stand-fast ceasefire, by which he meant that the South Vietnamese would be given, in effect, territorial control of all within their borders. The North Vietnamese were still talking of complete American withdrawal by June of 1971. They were still insisting that the leadership in Saigon be deposed, preparatory to the establishment of a coalition government for the entire country. We seemed pole apart. During 1970, it seemed at times that our involvement in Southeast Asia was broadening, not diminishing. We moved for a 60-day attack into Cambodia in the defense of the Lon Nol government. And we paid for South Vietnamese to move in and Thai troops to move in to Cambodia after we withdrew. We have rushed through major foreign aid bills for the Cambodian government. We've increased the rate of foreign aid payment to Thailand. In April and May, this country was torn apart again by another international debate as to the degree of our involvement in Southeast Asia. And both sides made outlandish claims, justifications of their positions. And yet with it all, when the year began, there was something on the order of 520,000 American troops in Southeast Asia. And as the year ends, there are 364,000 troops, American troops, in Southeast Asia. With it all, the level of battle activity diminished. One could see this from the diminishing casualty lists. During 1969, casualty lists were running at 200, 250 a week. During most of 1970, they were running at 50 and less than a week. One soldier to die in Southeast Asia is one too many. But 50 is 150 less than 200. And the years seem to indicate that Hanoi and Washington were warily feeling each other out as to the honesty of the professions which they were making. What did Vietnamization mean? Vietnamization implied a continuing U.S. presence of what was called housekeeping troops, even after our military first-line troops withdrew. How many? 10,000? 50,000? 100,000? 200,000? What did it mean when Hanoi spoke of a coalition government, one which was entirely communist? One which would allow representation from the various groups within Vietnam? No one knew. Our delegates met across the table at the Hotel Raphael in Paris, and there was propaganda, and there were great speeches. There seemed little progress. But in Southeast Asia, despite all the confused evidence, though everything seemed somewhat more mushy, slushy than it had been before, one sensed again a glimmer of possibility. One sensed that men were trying to work their way out of what would be, on a theoretical level, a total impasse. For most of us, the slushiness of 1970 was evidenced in the economy, in our personal lives. We had to work harder, and we profited less. This country was in a slump. Prices were going up. We endured inflation on the order of 6 to 7% during the year. Real income was going down. The real gross national product of the United States, the real value of all our goods and services, actually fell during the year. We were having a recession and an inflation at the same time. And for many of us, this made a great change in our standard of living. There was a question, could we do all that we had done up to now? Could we continue to indulge ourselves in sending our children to expensive colleges and sending ourselves on expensive vacations, on purchasing a home which is more expensive than the one that we lived in now? The government had offered us, as the year began, simple solutions again, hurried solutions to the economic problems of the nation. The first solution was to cut back the national budget. The second solution offered us by our government was to increase the interest rates in order to limit the rate of inflation. So interest rates went up and the economy went down. And we cut our national budget and we found we were cutting necessary welfare and educational and recreational and ecological services. But there were no simple solutions. We recognized the problems which confronted the American economy were the problems of a generation of self-indulgence, of workers whose wage demands had increased faster than their productivity, of management which had been incredibly incompetent and self-indulgent. One has only to read the record of the Penn Central fiasco. One is only to see how government agencies, procurement agencies, have had to bail out major corporations dealing in billions of dollars worth of government contracts. We saw an economy where every one of us has lived very high on the hog. And the pig is not a kosher animal, and has never been. And a piggy society, a piggish society, cannot long be a strong one. Americans seemingly were beginning to hold up a mirror to themselves, or hopefully were. And as we walked through the slush, as we began to sort out the problems which confronted us, we recognized that to survive, we would have to work harder. We would have to be more disciplined in our appetites. In order for our great cultural and educational institutions to survive, they would demand greater sacrifice of us. Higher taxes, higher gifts, and gifts which we could no longer give out of monopoly money. Greater demands, citizenship, were required of all of us in this year of the slush. The nation was strong, but the will had yet to be tested. Everywhere we turned, hurry up simple solutions, the question. And we began to recognize that we were going to have to watch our step to work out realistic solutions, partial solutions, that total solutions were not possible. We thought we could never live with a communist government in the Western Hemisphere. And then one was elected in Chile, Mr. Allende's, and we have learned that we could live with him. For 25 years, we played the ostrich and we said, China, the most populous nation on the face of the earth, simply does not exist. And finally, our president in 1970 said, yes, we can begin to work out some practical economic relationships with China. We've had in the back of our minds the assumption that if only an economy is sound, then all the social problems begin to diminish. And we saw to our north, Canada, a nation of strong economy, a nation still exploiting its own frontier, tear itself apart to a certain degree with nationalist passion, with terrorism, which had nothing to do with the economy and seemed not to be diminished by the economic advantage which Canada was undergoing, but in fact to be intensified by prosperity. We told ourselves for a long time that if only we did this or that, if only we had more money to put into education, more money to put into social welfare, more money to put into public housing, more money to put into the solution of our national problem, these, in fact, would be solved. Now we're coming off a decade where we did put vast amounts of money into these activities, and we have hardly begun their solution. Because the solution of all national problems depend upon people. Upon the willingness of men and women to throw themselves into citizenship, to commit themselves to lives where the paychecks are not sky high, to undertake responsibilities dealing with other peoples, to undertake to sacrifice for the common weal. Everyone is wanted. and few have wanted to give. Perhaps the best way of typifying the slushiness of 1970, the change of mood which I saw, which we all saw happening during the year, is to indicate what has happened upon our campuses. During most of 1960, the campuses were the center of ferment. And what was being, the campuses were being attacked. Why? Because they were not producing adequate education. Because they were not properly training the young people. Because they were not properly playing a role in the society to take those whom the elementary schools and the high schools had not qualified for college and training them to be proper college graduates. They were not playing a social welfare role. Because they were not properly involving themselves in the ongoing responsibilities of citizenship in the communities in which they lived. Whether it was trees or the ghetto or South Vietnam, whatever the issue, the colleges were supposed to be the place where solutions would be found and where there was power in order to see that these problems were worked out in the community. And what's the problem of the colleges in 1970? Simply to survive, to have enough money to pay the professors, to have enough money to have an adequate library, to have enough money to have courses to offer the young people. We placed such demands, such hopes in our institutions that we forgot that they are all limited by income, by possibility, by reality. And so as the year ends, the question is not how much can the university do, but can the university really survive? Can the university survive? Can the symphony survive? Can our libraries survive? Can our public school systems survive? These are the problems which we face as 1970 moves into 1971. The real problem which Americans, which the world faces, but particularly which Americans face, is to disembarrass ourselves of a kind of Christian apocalyptic vision, secularized, of course, still present, which has been part of our national makeup, lo, these many years. Apocalyptic visions are those visions which say there is an end of time, there is paradise, there is utopia, there is possibility, there is the Messiah, and he will come shortly. It's ultimately hopeful. It sees quick solutions. In Jesus' time, the solution was to leave off one's family, to leave one's business, to go out in the wilderness, to prepare oneself for the coming of the Messiah. Our visions are more secular, but that spirit is still there. Ecology is a problem. We have an Earth Day. The problem is solved. Race is a problem. We deal with civil rights. We pass some national civil rights legislation. The problem is solved. The economy has a problem. We will beef up taxes. We will cut down our budget. We will raise the interest rates. The problem is solved. Well, problems are not solved in that way, and the solution of one problem is the beginning of another. Yes, we must live with hope. But the long hope, the Jewish hope. When the Jews gave their creed, they came to the creed of the Messiah, they said it in a strangely involuted way. I believe in the coming of the Messiah. But even though he is delayed, yet will I await him. There was the acceptance, even as we uttered the hope, that the hope would not come. There was the admission that we will live in the slush and the mush and the dirt as long as we live, and that we will continue, despite that realism, to move as much as we can towards a goal of a brighter tomorrow. Well, Americans, I'm afraid, particularly in the world also, are going to have to give up impatience. We're going to have to give up the sense of urgency which has led us to simplicity, which has led us to ideology, which has given us instant recipes. We live in a society where everything is instant. Instant food, instant drink, instant entertainment. You flick a switch. We also want an instant paradise. Afal pi sheyitmameh, even though it's delayed, It's not going to come now. It's not going to come in our lifetime. You and I are going to live through a generation, and our children after us will live in an era where they will be burdened and freighted and weighted with problems. There's no quick road to glory. The world will be complex at each other's throat. The nations will be at each other's throat. There will be international tension. The economy will be stretched to the breaking point. The sacrifices will necessarily be demanded of us beyond any of which we have yet dreamed. We're going to have to give up our indulgence and our sense of privilege. We're going to have to share much more than we've ever shared before of what we have, and not merely of our surplus upon our surplus. Then perhaps, but not till then, a new year dawns. It's going to be another year of slush, another year of tension, confusion, of difficulty, of burden, of taxes, of frustration. I wish I could promise you a better year. You're alive. With life there is hope. There's a challenge. The challenge gives meaning to life. There's work to be done. And work gives life a sense of its own dignity. There's a challenge. Everything that man really needs for spiritual satisfaction, to be fully a human being. I believe in the coming of the Messiah, but I also believe that he'll be delayed beyond my lifetime, beyond yours.